From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland today, President Trump praised the passage of tax cuts and his handling of the U.S. economy.
We are creating an environment that attracts capital, invites investment, and rewards production. America is the place to do business. So come to America, where you can innovate, create, and build.
In that speech, Trump also described the U.S. immigration system as stuck in the past. The White House yesterday released a proposal that would grant citizenship for some young immigrants, but in return would fund the wall and reduce some forms of legal immigration.
And at Davos, world leaders booed Trump today when, during an impromptu question and answer session, he complained about how vicious and how fake the press can be. Well, fake news is how he's describing the story first reported by the New York Times last night, that in June, he ordered the firing of FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller, a month after he fired FBI Director James Comey, and that President Trump only backed off because White House counsel Don McGahn threatened to quit rather than remove Mueller from the investigation into possible Trump campaign collusion with Russia. So, a few things to talk about on this Friday. Let's convene our Friday Politics Roundtable. This week we have Rick Klein, a political director for ABC News. He's in Washington. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He joins us from Miami. Hi, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
And Rick, just start with, you know, if the president, in this explosive four sources story in the New York Times, if he had followed through and ordered the firing of Mueller, and if it had happened, or even just by ordering the firing of Mueller, is there something illegal in that?
No, although as President Trump realized here and as President Nixon learned very famously during Watergate, people actually have to go through with that. And Rod Rosenstein, who's the acting attorney general who oversees this investigation, he's even said that he would have to do it for cause. So there are limits on presidential power. But if President wanted to fire Mueller, he could do it. He could do it. It would be, though, politically explosive. And that's exactly the revelation that's the relevance of this revelation, because right now we know that his annoyance with Mueller got to the stage that he wasn't just mulling publicly the possibility of a firing, but actually trying to set those wheels in motion over the summer.
Well, so there's that, and people are contemplating that today. But what does it mean that Trump and all of his aides have been saying for months they never thought about this? Everybody's trotting out the sound, and you're hearing all these montages, Kellyanne Conway, others saying, no, he never thought of that. And here's Trump himself back in August talking to reporters when stories were circulating that he did want to fire Robert Mueller.
I haven't given it any thought. I mean, I've been reading about it from you people. You say, I'm going to dismiss him. No, I'm not dismissing anybody. I mean, I want
that. Rick Klein, this appears to be not telling the truth. I mean, how is this resonating?
It is not telling the truth. And I think critically here that in learning about this last night, it was all news to us, but it almost certainly was not news to Robert Mueller. And the reason is Mueller has brought in people like the White House counsel, Don McGahn, people like Reince Priebus, Sean Spicer, other top White House officials have been in to see him. And if they are telling the truth, then they told him about this episode. And
because you can't lie to the FBI.
You can't lie to the FBI. You also can't claim executive privilege, as some of them did before Congress. Mueller, it appears, is getting answers and may at some point get answers from President Trump himself.
Rick, before we move on, I just want to ask you one more question. Who benefits from this news coming out? Don McGahn? I mean, who might have had an interest in calling the New York Times and saying, you should put this story in your paper about how President Trump was going to fire Mueller?
Lots of theories out there. My favorite is that it actually benefits White House counsel in the sense that President Trump would now be on record as knowing this was the case. And if and when he sits down with Robert Mueller, he really can't lie about this. If he can't deny that this happened, because it is now confirmed that Mueller knows about it.
Alan Gomez, go ahead.
I mean, I was just going to say, I just wanted to look at this from a slightly different perspective. Yesterday, before the news came out, I had a long sit down with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. And we were assessing, you know, Trump's first year, talking about the future of the party. And, you know, obviously not a lot of love lost between those two after that 2016 Republican primary. But what Bush was most concerned about is the effect that this president is going to have on the Republican Party as a whole heading into the 2018 midterm elections. The way he sees it, if Democrats can nationalize those races, in other words, make them about Trump rather than local issues, in his words, the Republicans will lose. And every day that we get another series of stories like this is just more panic for that Republican Party, that the focus is going to remain on Trump and remain on these kind of stories.
Well, clearly one of the big issues issues this year is going to be immigration, and I want to ask you about that. Breitbart News is calling Trump Amnesty Don for offering an eventual path to citizenship for some young immigrants in that proposal that came out yesterday. On Fox News yesterday, Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee didn't sound like she was in favor of the idea.
There is more conversation about a path to legalization, and here is why. We do not want to see anyone get in front of people that have been going through the legal immigration process.
Alan, what do you think is going to happen in the next couple of weeks on the issue of Dreamers and the wall and immigration and maybe another government shutdown?
Well, I mean, as Breitbart put it with Amnesty Don, the Center for Immigration Studies, a group that advocates against immigration, they referred to this as the art of the choke. Mm-hmm. And basically what the president managed to do is something very rare. He unified Washington. Republicans are opposed to this plan because it legalizes too many Dreamers. Liberals and Democrats are opposed to this plan because it represents what amounts to nearly 25% reduction in legal immigration into the country. They say that is way too much. And so we're stuck here kind of where everything began, what the congresswoman was just talking about right there. You know, it sort of sounds like the debates we've been having over the past 20 years. Everyone's kind of dug into their sides, and I just don't see how they're going to resolve this in just the next couple of weeks.
Well, Alan, let's talk a little bit more about what this bill does, because the president might have had his eye on the polls. Most Americans want those, quote, dreamers, people the DACA recipients brought here as children, want them to have a path to citizenship or at least extend their ability to stay here. He knows that. But this plan also cuts what people who don't like it call chain migration immigration. Other people call it family reunification. It's the way most Americans who've come to this country have come. One person comes, they do well. A wife comes, then a child comes. That is eliminated in this proposal.
Yeah, so on the Dreamer side of things, I think the concern from so many conservatives is how many of them will get legal status. Under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program created by President Obama and terminated by President Trump, there was about 800,000 of them that were protected, and there's been a lot of talk about Congress creating a legal mechanism for them to stay here, maybe allowing them to become citizens. But what the White House did was, in their words, make a huge concession by going up to, you know, adding an extra million people to that group. On the flip side, right, Democrats are very concerned about family reunification. Right now, if you're a U.S. citizen or a green card holder, you can sponsor your spouse, your children, your minor children and adult children, your parents, some nephews and nieces, and in some cases, your grandchildren. They're going to cut most of that and only allow your spouse and your minor children to come into the country. And for them, that represents just way too much.
So, Rick, is the government going to shut down again in a couple of weeks?
We'll be right back where we started. I think that that's a savvy way to put it. Look, 2 weeks to solve things that have taken two decades to get through. There's been enormous pressure on Democrats to make sure that this is the moment that Dreamers get delivered on, because there aren't that many moments for leverage for Democrats these days. So I think it's very likely that we are staring down another shutdown in just a few weeks' time. The president putting out his framework, I don't know that that's advanced the discussion, although I think there's significant pressure on the White House to say what President Trump is actually for, because he has been, frankly, all over the map on this issue.
Okay, we want to take a look abroad because President Trump was on British TV with the host Piers Morgan, who asked him to apologize for his retweet, you know, this was last November, of that anti-Muslim video, which was produced by a far-right British hate group. Let's listen.
Here's what's fair. If you're telling me there's a horrible people, horrible racist people, I would certainly apologize if you'd like me to do that. I know nothing about them.
And Piers went on to say, you would disavow yourself of people. And Trump said, I don't want to be involved with people. You're telling me about these people because I know nothing about these people. Rick, what do we make of this? You know, knows nothing about something that he's retreating, causing at that time a huge international spasm.
That's what I found out about this. This was a very big deal at the time. So for the president to say he was unaware of this, the White House was asked about it very directly about what the president's sentiments were in this. It also is about as close to an apology as you'll ever hear from President Trump. He very rarely backtracks in any way. to me, it suggests that he did not want the headline out of this trip to Davos to be that he is doubling down in his support for right-wing extremist groups or in any way apologizing for them. It's a more disciplined Trump, perhaps, to say, look, I didn't know about it. I wasn't trying to cause any offense. It is different than the initial White House explanation. And I think it was a bit strategic in just saying, I don't want this to dominate the headlines.
Mm. Alan Gomez, the State of the Union address is coming up next Tuesday. What are you expecting?
I think a lot of the same. I mean, he's gonna talk a lot about immigration. If the last year is any guide, he's gonna talk a lot about sort of the crime that undocumented immigrants commit in this country. He's gonna talk about the need for a border wall. I assume we're not going to hear any comments about foreign countries like he's, you know, like the language he's used when it comes to Haiti and several African nations. But I don't think in any way he's going to back down from his view that his focus needs to be on American workers and on ensuring that terrorists and other folks can't get into the country.
He'll probably also claim the tax cuts, appointment to the Supreme Court. So we'll see. Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Too bad there's nothing going on. Thank you both for weighing in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Grammys are Sunday, and this is the title track from A Moment Apart, the new album from the Seattle-based electronic duo Odessa. They're nominated for Best Dance Electronic Album. But for Odessa's millions of fans in the underground electronic scene that birthed them, the album is more than a dance album. Harrison Mills and Clayton Knight formed Odessa in 2012 when they were classmates at Western Washington University. They named the band after Harrison's uncle's ship, which sank. Only the uncle and a crewmate survived. They've said it underscores the emotion in their music. And they join us now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Harrison, hello.
Hello.
And Clayton Knight, you there?
I am here, yes. Thanks for having us.
First of all, how are you feeling about the Grammys?
Good, good.
Nervous. We haven't written anything, so I don't know.
We'll see.
Scared if it happens.
It'll be our first time going, so we're pretty pumped to see the whole show.
Well, you know, you are fresh and new for a lot of people, and yet have been adored by millions. When you go online to hear some of your music, the comments are just religious in nature. How would you describe your music? Harrison, how would you describe it?
Ooh, that's really tough. I think we try really hard to blend lots of different genres together. So it's always kind of been tough for me to try to pinpoint one thing. But I would say it's definitely an electronic backbone, but there's influence. It's hard because I could say like our top influences in it, but it's like kind of like a mixture of indie music, hip hop, and like almost synth pop.
Well, and I don't think it does it justice to call it dance music or dance electronic, because there is not a spirituality. What is it you're trying to get across?
I'm not sure. It's kind of a euphoric feeling that we like when we listen to music, like those kind of the chills you get when you hear a really good song. Mm-hmm. We try to get that out of our music as much as possible. So if it's not kind of making the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, it's not something we're going to be into. So that's what we try to push, those moments and those kind of euphoric feelings throughout our music, as well as blending a bunch of different sounds together and trying to experiment as much as possible.
Yeah, it's almost the way I feel when I hear Toto and Africa, but it's got a whole new vibe to it. Let's listen to a little of the Grammy-nominated song again for Best Dance Recording, Line of Sight. Clayton Knight, what are the different layers? Like, what's going on? I know there's computer playback, drum line. What's going on?
Yeah, so this track's been kind of a work in progress for a long time. So Rory Andrews, or Wynn, is the lead vocalist. So he sent us a really rough demo with this kind of synth pad and just his vocals at the beginning. And so we kind of loved the sound he had, loved the ideas, but wanted to kind of beef it up. And so we kind of added these big drums and kind of these big bass lines as well, and then tried to really amp up the energy near this chorus section as much as possible. So it took about 2 months of back and forth between him and us, fine-tuning different sounds and whatnot, till we got something we really liked, and this is kind of what came out of it.
Who's the female voice?
So that's just a pitched vocal verse that Rory did, actually. Huh. So he's just kind of, I think there's not even real lyrics to it, so he's just kind of jamming on it, and then it pitched up a little bit. So will you help me die? Then the end part, there's an end part that kind of lifts near the last chorus that the Manchinera guys helped write. They're also featured on the song. They're doing all the background vocals. They have this kind of beautiful choir-esque feel to them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a lot of different layers, a lot of different elements going on and kind of hopefully working together.
Talk about the live experience. I was reading about your show at the Barclay Center in Brooklyn. It's spectacular. I mean, there's fire and pyrotechnics, and the two of you standing on a platform firing back, or, you know, what's going on?
So we kind of approach our live show as a completely different beast. A lot of our music is fairly intimate and personal. It's like a lot of the time headphone music. And so when we approach our live show, we want it to match the setting. And we have a horn line, we have a guitarist, we have a 6-person drum line. And then we have obviously a light show and visuals and all these different things. And me and Clay are drumming and twisting knobs and doing all sorts of stuff. So this recent show took us about 4 months.
So to be more clear about what you're doing.
Well, this is Clayton. So the live element on our end is basically we have these two MIDI controllers that allow us to play various pieces of the song. So they're what are called stems, which are just the broken down elements of a track. So one stem could just be the kick, one stem could just be the snare, one stem could just be the vocal. So we have control over each individual piece of every song, so we can loop different pieces, reverse different pieces, layer them with other songs. So you got this huge palette of different sounds to work with and kind of mix and match different things. So that's going on, as well as us playing live drums and electronic drums. And then we also have our drum line with us.
Talk about the drum line. It has its own Instagram.
yes, it's become a very integral part of the show. And we kind of experimented with the idea of adding them a long while back, and then we met the Colorado drum line when we brought them out for one of our Red Rock shows, and just kind of fell in love with their passion. And they've kind of been adding so much to the show and working on choreographing different elements and kind of just being a part of it in a way that, you know, the other drum lines just weren't. And we kind of decided this last run we want to take them on the road, and they're basically part of the full show at this point.
I want to listen to another piece from the album, the Grammy-nominated album, A Moment Apart. You worked with a lot of artists. Regina Spektor, you were fans of hers. It sounds like you didn't dream that she would end up on your album.
We were little fanboys of her since high school. And it was kind of a name we threw out, just not really thinking anything of it, because we just figured she was too big or too much a part of a different world than us. And it just kind of all lucked out that she liked the demos we sent, and we became friends. And it was a really awesome part of making this album, and I think a goal we achieved that we always kind of wanted to. I don't want us just to be a memory. Baby, come back and fight with me. I don't want us just to be a memory.
That's Regina Spektor singing on the new album from the band Odessa, A Moment Apart. And I want to listen to soul singer Leon Bridges. He is featured on Across the Room. Long hair crossed the room, baby, she got that glow. I know you see me over here, so dance on me real slow. We've been going for about 2 hours, and I don't even know your name. So baby, please reveal. That's the young soul singer Leon Bridges on the song Across the Room. The new album from the band Odessa, A Moment Apart. We've got the duo behind Odessa here, Harrison Mills, Clayton Knight. Clayton, who's your wish list?
Well, obviously, Leon was one of those, so we've been huge fans of him for a long time. And he was just kind of in Seattle one day doing a private gig, and we're like, hey, you got some free time to pop in the studio? Haven't met him before. You know, you never know how those things are going to go, because it can always, sometimes it can be a little awkward, just feeling out the energy in the room. But yeah, it came together really fast. We just showed him a couple beats and he took to it really well. And we wrote that whole thing kind of in 1 8-hour session, which is pretty unreal.
Mm-hmm. And Harrison, I'm wondering, you've got this indie sound, as you said, certainly indie start. Your new album, more than 1.5 million views on YouTube. You're on Spotify and all these streaming ways of getting to your music. Do you feel like you're crossing over from one world to another? Do you worry that these loyal fans of yours, they've been able to be a part of your world online? And now, I mean, there's a certain pride, I'm sure. You'll be up at the Grammys, but has anyone expressed concern? Oh, my God, you're selling out or you're going into that mainstream world?
I think we've tried really hard to just stay really authentic and genuine to the sound we've always wanted to create. And I mean, all of this came as a huge surprise. So I don't feel like there's really been much backlash to that. I think you'll never make everyone happy. But I mean, we made conscious decisions to have Regina Spektor and Leon Bridges be our like biggest features, you know, and like mm-hmm. Rye X, who are all these indie artists that we just really enjoy. You know, we try really hard to kind of stay authentic to ourselves, and hopefully that shines through.
Yeah. How much did Washington, the state of Washington, form you? You want to take that, Clayton?
Well, Washington's been kind of our home since we can remember. You know, the writing and kind of the weather in general definitely adds to the energy. But so this last album, we had probably the longest, hardest winter in Seattle that I can remember. It literally rained for like a month straight. So we were just kind of locked in the studio during this dreary weather trying to write some music. But, it kind of really added to this kind of internal energy that you don't get. There's really no distractions or reasons to go outside. So we spent, you know, a lot of time just kind of exploring different worlds and adding as much as we can. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, Pacific Northwest is known for its indie music and kind of folk background. And I think a lot of that seeps in to our music here and there.
Yeah. Well, best of luck to both of you.
Thank you.
I just want to say I've been a huge fan of you for a very long time, an avid NPR listener,
Aww.
So it's quite an honor to be on here.
Okay, then I really want you to win.
I just want to say I've been a much bigger fan. I've recorded everything.
Odessa's Harrison Mills and Clayton Knight, they say they'll be the ones in flannel at the Grammys on Sunday. From Washington, get it.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for 2 all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garland, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Michigan State University Athletic Director Mark Hollis announced his resignation today, one day after President Luana Simon said she'd resign, following the sentencing of former staffer Larry Nassar, who abused 150 young athletes under the guise of treatment. And students are holding a march tonight to call for more change. Rachel Fredette is editor-in-chief of the school's student-run newspaper, The State News. She joins us from East Lansing. And Rachel, you and your editorial board wrote yesterday, "The fire's still burning, MSU."
I think we just wanted to make it abundantly clear that this is just a beginning. This is not some end. We reached a form of a goal when Luana K. Simon did resign, but the fire is still burning because there is still massive, massive problems at our university. I mean, if you look at what ESPN dropped yesterday, looking at how MSU's been handling sexual assault cases, this truly is just the beginning. There is a lot more work to do.
Yeah, there's criticism outside of Larry Nassar. And it's been going on for a long time. I mean, you started writing about this just as the Indianapolis Star did their investigation. Do you feel like you've been trying to tell the leaders of the school there's a bigger problem?
I think since we've been covering this since August of 2016, as it really picked up and we got into like February 2017 and MSU had just released a public statement about the situation, we were waiting for the national media attention, for lack of a better way to put it. We were waiting for them to arrive and in their trucks and for us to really, you know, have this be a conversation. And it took a lot longer. I mean, it took the amount of women and girls that spoke last week to really get us on the map.
Right.
A lot of local media has been following this for a while.
Meanwhile, what are you seeing students do? You've got a rock that gets painted, a tradition. What's going on?
They painted the rock, I believe, yesterday. They wrote all the names of all of the women and girls who spoke. They wrote thank you on the rock in teal. Teal is obviously the color for sexual assault awareness. Tom Izzo is our basketball coach. There's this kind of icon on our campus where all of the students at the game in the student section, it's called the Izzone, and it's the closest part to the court. It's a very big deal. They get a lot of attention during the games. They've all decided to wear teal, and they've actually been raising money. They're close to $2,000 for sexual assault programs here to support the survivors. So students are trying their best to make way with this. They want to be able to be there for these women.
Is there a feeling of almost shame that's around the school now?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I think these students are ashamed of what happened in a lot of respect here at Michigan State. And it happened for somebody who calls themselves a Spartan. That's something that we've been hearing a lot. I think these students are trying to bring out some form of reparations that the school hasn't exactly been supplying in larger demand. They want to apologize, and they seem more remorseful than what I've been seeing from the higher-ups in some of this respect.
Well, and you said that some of the women who were the victims or survivors actually, you know, get sick when they see the school colors.
Yeah, that was something that we've been hearing. I just can't imagine what that'd be like. I mean, a perfect example, one of their survivors, Larissa Boyce, we actually did a profile on her last year, and we asked her about why she still chose to go to MSU after she was abused by Nassar. She said MSU's her school, and she continued to support them. And I don't know if that's still true to this day, but it was something very strong in her to be able to still support something that had obviously she had had poor experiences at.
Yeah. Rachel Fredette, editor-in-chief of the State News, Michigan State University student-run newspaper. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The White House is facing backlash from anti-immigration groups for its new plan that would provide a path to citizenship for Dreamers and others brought to the country as children. But the plan would also greatly reduce what's called chain migration by those against it, family reunification by others. You know, one person comes, does well, brings other family members. White House advisor Stephen Miller drew up the plan, and journalist Jennifer Mendelson says that his own ancestors may not have been welcome under some of his proposed rules. Jennifer Mendelson's project, Tracing Ancestry of Policymakers, is called Resistance Genealogy. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
What made you want to do this?
Well, I am a journalist, but I am also a very passionate genealogist. I spent a lot of time tracing trees, looking at immigrant records, looking at naturalization papers. And for a long time, it was just sort of my strange and weird hobby. But over the past year or two, I've realized that the work that I've been doing has incredible resonance in the present. It's not just about the past. And I realize how important these stories are and how relevant these stories are. I'm also the granddaughter of immigrants. So my immigrant past is incredibly close and personal and intimate for me. And when I see all these people in the news talking about immigration in a way that seems so disingenuous, I just sort of chuckle to myself and think, don't you realize that you have this story too? It may be further back for you, but we all have these stories. I see them every day. Mm-hmm. So I just started looking into some of their stories. I thought it might be an interesting way to personalize this for them.
Well, for instance, Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa, CNN asked him in March of 2017 to clarify comments he'd made because they brought some criticism. And he told them he meant exactly what he said. Let's listen.
You cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. You've got to keep your birth rate up, and that you need to teach your children your values.
You can't rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies, meaning people who come in, immigrants who come in. You found what?
Well, as soon as I heard that, I just sort of the light bulb went off and I thought, someone else's babies? His family must have been someone else's babies at some point. So I started looking at his tree. It was relatively easy. And I found that his grandmother came to the U.S. as a 4-year-old with her baby sister and baby brother in tow. So there you have it. They were someone else's babies at one point.
They arrived in steerage at Ellis Island, New York, 1894 from Germany. Her name was Frieda Harm. By the way, how'd you find that?
There's a lot of websites that I use with all of these people. They're public figures, so there's a lot of information about who their parents were, and it's very easy once you start to just sort of tracing backwards using public records.
Yeah. Well, let's look at what else you found. Dan Scavino Jr., White House social media director, he tweeted an article about what he calls chain migration, choking the United States. Chain migration is a phrase that's used pejoratively by those who feel it's a chain of people who come, then pulling others behind them in. Others have called it family reunification, which is, you know, families being able to reunite with other family members once they've come in as legal immigrants. So what did you find about Dan Scavino Jr.?
Well, once again, being as intimately involved in genealogy as I am, the sort of term chain migration just sort of made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, because it's so obvious that they're trying to cast a very healthy and legal process as something sinister and dark. And they're using this word to sort of scare people, summoning up images of immigrants scurrying into the country and dragging a chain of undesirables behind them. And there's all these statistics being bandied about that aren't reliable about how many people each person can bring. And they're basically just trying to scare people. But anyone who's spent any time looking at American immigration history knows that chain migration is the way that virtually everybody comes here. So I decided to look at the Scavino family and see how they came. And it turned out that they were a poster child family for the process of chain migration, because Dan Scavino Jr.'s great-grandfather's elder brother had come first. He had brought over a second brother. Then he brought over Dan Scavino's great-grandfather. Then a sister came. Then another sister came, and the grandfather. I mean, so I refuse to talk about chain migration. The process is called family reunification, and there's nothing sinister or underhanded about it. It's about bringing families together.
Well, we should say they were all, you know, living together. And this was at a time, well, late 1800s into the early 1900s. This was at a time when Italians were considered completely undesirable. I mean, laws were passed to keep them out of the country, one historian told us, because it was thought that Italians and the Polish people could never be smart enough to adopt American values. I mean, it's hideous. And this would have been Dan Scavino's family.
Exactly. Well, I think part of what's going on here that's sort of implicit in this project is I am trying to show people that this is nothing new. These sorts of things have always been said about immigrants, and they've never been true, because if they were true about our ancestors, they're being said about the exact same people who descended from those people who were thought not to be good enough. The example I've often given to make it personal is that in my own family, I actually have one grandmother who was born in the U.S., and her American-born sisters looked down on my immigrant grandfather and thought that he was not worthy of their sister because he was a greenhorn, and they made a big deal about how he was beneath them. So I decided to look at the records, and I realized that my grandmother's sister was born in New York City in 1895. Her mother had arrived in the U.S. in 1891. 4 years earlier. And I just keep thinking to myself, it only takes 4 years to breed that sort of entitlement or sense that, well, I was born here, I'm better than you. And I realize in my family, it's 4 years, so it's very easy to see. But for some people, when that becomes 100 years or 150 years, it's not so easy to see. But all these things have been said about immigrants before.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to White House senior advisor Stephen Miller, who's the one said to be whispering in President Trump's ear very hardline thoughts on immigration, and especially when it comes to language. What did you find out about Stephen Miller?
Well, Stephen Miller comes from a pretty classic Eastern European Jewish immigrant success story, but I found it particularly ironic. He gave a White House press briefing last summer in which he talked about how the Trump administration's immigration policies would favor immigrants who could already speak English.
This was when the administration presented its skill-based immigration plan back in August. Stephen Miller drafted that one as well. It would limit the family-based migration we talked about, but also force green card recipients to speak English before arriving in the U.S. And Miller got into a big dust-up with CNN's Jim Acosta at a briefing. Let's just listen to a little.
This whole notion of, well, they could learn, you know, they have to learn English before they get to the United States. Are we just going to bring in people from Great Britain and Australia?
Jim, I have to honestly say, I am shocked at your statement that you think that only people from Great Britain and Australia would know English.
So that's White House aide Stephen Miller back in August, not backing down from his plan then, requiring legal immigrants to speak English. Genealogist Jennifer Mendelson, you did what?
Again, knowing as I do the sort of typical arc of Eastern European Jewish immigrant families in America, I decided to take a look at his own family and see if they could speak English. And I found in the 1910 census his great-grandmother, Sarah Miller, and at that time in the census, the enumerator would indicate whether each person could speak English. And it said that she had arrived 4 years earlier, but that she could not speak English.
She spoke only Yiddish 4 years after coming to the U.S. And he wrote in a college op-ed that worshiping at the altar of multiculturalism might lead to the sacrifice of the one culture which binds us all. And there you have in his own family somebody not speaking English.
I think the subtext here is just that it's crucial that we point these things out, that the idea that not being able to speak English when you come somehow should prevent you from coming, because we all come, or many of us come, from these incredibly humble roots of uneducated people who came here and were given opportunity. My own great-grandmother was completely illiterate, and two of my brothers have PhDs, and that's how it works. We take in people with limited opportunity, and we give them opportunity. That's what frustrates me so much about the rhetoric we're seeing, and that's what inspired this project. It is the most beautiful and fundamental piece of being American in my mind. And yes, times have changed. No, it is not 100 years ago. Yes, we need to craft policy that respects the realities of life today. But we have to do so with a compassion and an understanding that our immigrant past makes us great, and immigrants continue to contribute to this country and will continue to contribute to this country.
That's Jennifer Mendelson, journalist, creator of the new project, hashtag resistance genealogy. We'll hook you up at herenow.org. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Many cities around the country are trying to put regulations in place to deal with short-term rentals done through companies like Airbnb and HomeAway. In Nashville this week, the Metro Council voted overwhelmingly for new regulations to phase out short-term rentals of non-owner-occupied properties in residential neighborhoods. Joining us now by Skype is Larry Hagar, a Nashville Metro Councilman who was the lead sponsor of the legislation. Larry, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And why was this so important for Nashville?
Well, over the past 2 years, we'd been getting so many complaints about some of the non-owner-occupied short-term rentals in the residential and residential single neighborhoods. And because enforcement was very difficult, we came along and said, well, to try to compromise with Airbnb and HomeAway and some of the other platforms, we would phase out the non-owner-occupieds in the residential and residential single districts. This would be a phase-out program, though, that they would be allowed to get permits up till 2020. 26, 27 other cities across Tennessee have passed similar legislation as well.
Why not just ban these short-term rentals altogether?
I think they're very important. They do provide opportunities for people to supplement their income with renting out a portion of their homes. We don't want to take that completely away from our residents here in Nashville.
So explain who will still be able to rent out a room in their house or something like that.
Well, you can still rent out rooms in the house, even if you're in the residential and residential single neighborhoods. But you have to be what we call owner-occupied. The owner would be there so they can control the behavior of any of their guests. Now, the non-owner occupied will still be allowed in what we call the MUN, MUL, or multifamily districts, which are like condos, apartments. You can still have the non-owner occupied in those districts.
I assume Airbnb and HomeAway would prefer none of these regulations, but how much of a fight was it to go up against companies like that?
It's huge. They have a lot of money. They hire a lot of lobbyists. And, of course, the threat was always that they'd go to the state legislature and try to preempt us, which they did last year. It got held up in the Finance Committee. What's interesting, though, is since last year when that bill got held up, you've had Knoxville and Chattanooga, a couple of the larger metropolitan areas, that have passed legislation similar to 608. So they may have a difficult time convincing those representatives and senators to preempt those large metropolitan areas.
Do you think that this new legislation is going to have a meaningful impact on home prices in Nashville?
No, not at all. Nashville still is growing by leaps and bounds. The three-year phase-out gives these people an opportunity to get their investment back. They can either go to a long-term rental agreement or they can sell their property. And right now, I would easily say that real estate in this area is still rising at 5 to 10% a year.
What's your response to people who say they should be able to do what they want with their property, that if they want to rent it out short term, why shouldn't they be able to?
Well, zoning laws were enacted, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to say, okay, if we've got a residential neighborhood, then it needs to stay residential. So if we're going to allow commercial business in residential neighborhoods, then why do we have any zoning at all? And this was not intended to be any type of property right, because you have to get a permit every year and you have to renew that permit every year. So people that live in a residential neighborhood, they want to know who their neighbors are, who lives around them. They want peace and quiet and quality of life. And with different people coming in every week or every weekend, they don't know who's staying next door to them.
I imagine the hotel industry in Nashville is pretty happy with this.
You know, I haven't talked to them. To me, that was not really a big factor, because right now there's about 4,000 motel rooms coming online in the next year. The motel industry here is pretty fast and furious in building some new motels and hotels.
As you know, a lot of cities around the country are dealing with this very same issue and trying to put regulations on how much people can rent out rooms in their house or their entire house. What would your advice be to other cities that are trying to do the same thing that you are?
I think you just try to find a good balance between your residents and citizens of your city and the industry itself, because, you know, I think the short-term rental business is a very viable industry. A lot of people use it. But at the same time, you want to protect your quality of life of your residents and your citizens of your city as well.
That's Larry Hagar, who is a Nashville Metro Councilman, a man behind some new legislation that limits people's ability to offer short-term rentals in the non-owner-occupied properties in residential neighborhoods in Nashville. Larry Hagar, thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.